Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, is daf Tzadi Hey. And you'll notice that Kavi is here because his face reminds us to be learning for the Ilui Nishmas Yisroel Ben Aryeh, who is Kavi's Sadie.
Exactly.
All right. So we start with our Halakha Mishnah. And we figure if he can have a Gavi as a grandson, then it's definitely Kedai for us to learn for Yisroel ben Aryeh's Aliyas Neshama. Because we're Nana from him every day, right? All right, so we're holding at the Halakha Mishnah on the top of Daf Tzadik Hey, and we're back to more normal people. This guy only married two wives. So we've gone from two to three to four, and now we're back to two again. So here we get into another fascinating issue. Now, remember, we've spoken in the past about the question of whether a woman relinquishes certain rights and she says she's not going to collect from a certain property. And the shaila is, if there was more than one woman, can she relinquish vis-a-vis one and not vis-a-vis the other? Can you relinquish your right to a claim against a property, but not relinquish a right to your overall claim for your ketuvah and maintain your lien on other properties and so on and so forth? This is where we got up to until now. But the question is that we get into some very fascinating, vicious circles when we do this kind of thing. Because once we've established that you can maintain a claim and relinquish a lien, then you understand that it's very easy to come up with situations when you only relinquish the claim against one individual and you say, I won't pursue the claim, which is how we started the whole discussion in this paragraph. I won't pursue the claim. That doesn't mean that I'm not owed the money. I'll pursue it against someone else. I only said I won't pursue it against you. So it's easy to come up with cases where someone else who does have a claim against the property and you can claim against that person can then actually be attacked by you in court for the very thing that you agreed not to attack the other person for. And then the question is whether that first person, since you promised that you won't act against them, can then take it back and then have the second person come and say, but he bought it, and then have you take it away, and so on ad infinitum. So, I mean, we can come up with ad infinitum cases like this. And so what we need to do is to establish what is going to happen with the difference between maintaining a right to a claim versus relinquishing your rights to pursue an individual or a particular property. Now, that, of course, you understand immediately is going to lead us into all kinds of fascinating situations. Because remember that the entire idea of the way we have come up with a system by which liens work is based on maintaining market forces. So therefore, we don't, first of all, allow people to utilize a lien, even though it exists, if it isn't a registered lien. Why is that? Because since you cannot do your due diligence in the event that there's no way to get the information, we're crushing the market. Who is going to buy if they could be taken away from them? That's the first issue. Another issue that we did in order to insure is insurance. In other words, we have the concept of achrayut, which is automatic the way we paskin, as Gavi remembers, I hope, that the achrayut is considered to be to'ut sofer, and that if it doesn't actually include a clause in a contract providing property insurance, the property insurance is automatically provided by the possession of the contract. There's no question about it, unless you stipulate otherwise. Okay, but there's another balance that we have to take into consideration over here. And that's the idea of hinachti, Gavi, please start writing, hinachti lecha makom ligvot aleha. I have left you a place to collect from, which means that due diligence, in a sense, is impossible if you really think about it. Because what am I supposed to do? I want to buy a $1 million field from a particular guy. I'm worried that somebody else has got a claim against this guy. So I check out what he currently owns. I check out any debts that I know are registered. How do we register a lien? By making it contractual, and then the word gets out, right? That's one of the values of having a contract, as opposed to dealing with things between the two of you or orally, which is considered to be an unregistered lien. Again, all of this has been a rabbanan for the takana of society. So this is called tikkun olam or the takana sashok. So what I do is I say, okay, look, when I bought this, I knew that there were other loans that were up against it, you know, but I checked out to make sure that there were enough properties for all of the creditors that this guy has to get their loans paid back. So that's called due diligence. Now, we have to consider, and what happens if there is a change after that? And there can be changes for a lot of reasons. Namely, let's think about the idea where the creditor himself signs off of the property. So the field that I left behind for him to collect from, he writes the guy and he makes a kinyan, as we're going to see. I'm not going to go after that property. Can he come after my property? Because he had a prior lien against my property? Or do we say, if you do your due diligence, we remove any liens against your property? So if somebody wants to sign off, he can't expect to go and be able to attack someone else who did his due diligence, because then we're back to where we were before. I mean, this is open to all types of horrific manipulation. Suppose a guy makes a deal with someone to whom he owed money that he's going to pay him on the side if he agrees to sign off from a property to exercise his lien and so on, then he signs off and he goes and he collects from a property that had already been sold by a person who did due diligence by leaving behind that property. Who knows what kind of shtick this is, they say, foil a shtick, because you're going out to foil the other guy's collection. Okay, so you're left open to foil a shtick, as they say in Yiddish. And because of that, can we allow a guy who signs off to go and use his prior lien against someone who did due diligence? Is the due diligence, by definition, the removal of all liens or not? That's one question we have to consider. And let me ask you something else. What if something happens to the property that you left behind? What if you were dumb enough to put your lien on a property in Orlando, Florida, which by the time you come to collect is underwater? So here you thought you were in Disneyland and you're actually in Waterworld. What happens? So there, I mean, it's not foreseeable that this is going to happen. So in that case, do we actually say, well, what can we do? You had the prior lien and therefore you could collect. Or do we say, listen, you left behind that you did your due diligence, and due diligence includes not having to worry about hurricanes and stuff like that. So all of these issues are going to be beautifully raised by this Mishnah. So the first case that we have is a vicious circle. What do we do about vicious legal circles? So here's the case. Simple case. Guy's got two wives, okay? He sells his field, and the field that he sells was basically Mishu'ubad to both of these women's ketuvot. Now, the first wife, who had the prior lien, she writes to the one who bought the property, I'm not going to pursue any kind of claim against you about this. Now that, and she phrases it in such a way, as we're going to see, she phrases it in a way that means, I am not going to prevent you from having this field. Not simply that she won't go after him in court, but that she won't take any action that will prevent his collection. Okay. Then when the husband dies, that means that wife number two can collect directly from him because she didn't sign off. And the prior lien, the woman said, well, I'm not going to collect. But now wife number two has the field. Now wife number one never said, I'm not going to collect from wife number two, did she? So then she goes and she takes, utilizing her prior lien, she takes away the field from wife number one. The buyer comes along from wife number two. The buyer comes along and says to wife number one, Thank you so much, because I've wanted to get this field back and I'm walking off with it because you promised that you won't take any action to prevent me from having this field. So now I have the field. Then, of course, wife number two comes along and says, ah, you have that field? I'll take that field from you. And wife number one comes and says, oh, so I have a prior lien on that field. I'll take it from you. And this goes on ad infinitum, right? So what do we do in a case like this? So then again, the Shnia takes it from the Lokeach. The Rishona takes it from the Shnia. The Lokeach takes it from the Rishona. And the merry-go-round keeps moving. V'chozrot chalila. This is ad infinitum. Until they make a deal. So they've got to make a deal between themselves. Now, what this means, says Tosfos, is not that the court is seriously going to get involved in this nonsense. I mean, we're going to lend our hands to this? So what it means is that we've got a judicial concept of a chozrot chalila. We will refuse to entertain any motions in this nonsense until they decide what they're going to do. And the truth is, they have to decide very quickly. Why? Because if any two of them decide against the third, then there's big problems, right? Because we don't need a unanimous agreement. If at any point the merry-go-round stops, then that's where it stops, correct? So now any of the parties can speak to any of the other parties, agree to pay them a little bit on the side, or reach some kind of compromise with them, which cancels out the third guys, right? So let's say the first wife says, okay, you know what? If you give me X amount of money, I am not going to take this away from you, my co-wife, a second wife, all right? So then the buyer is up the creek without a paddle. So he's nervous that that's going to happen, okay? But if the second wife makes a deal with the buyer, that she's not going to take it with the buyer, so then the first wife is up the creek without a paddle, okay? And if the buyer makes a deal with the first wife that he's not going to take it away from her if she takes it away from wife number two and she's getting money under the table, so then wife number two is up the creek without a paddle. So therefore, they all have very good reasons to make a deal and fast. So therefore, the Bezdin sits back and watches the virtual merry-go-round until it gets a serious claim by someone who can show that it stops here. Okay. This is, of course, the opposite of the buck stops here. Over here, it's actually that the property stops here. And there is this idea is true all over. It's true about a balchov, and it's true with a woman who is a balchov against her husband. Now, we don't understand what that is coming to add. And the Gemara is going to discuss what are those cases supposed to be adding to us. But before we even begin all of the fun, how can you sign off? Didn't we had before the question of signing off doesn't mean anything. It's just a promise. So I changed my mind. I told you I'm not going to go after your field. I changed my mind. Go ahead, do me something. In order to give somebody something, you have to give it to him with a gift. How can you gift something that is not giftable? So the whole thing can't happen because it says beferish in the bride, there's somebody, omer lechavero, and this doesn't mean only verbally. Whatever, you write it, you make a contract, dinu dvarim ein li al sadasu. We had this language. Ainli esek ba. I have nothing to do with it. This is what we have the cases of the husband who, and or the wife who write this to each other. Yadimisu leketemena. My hand is out of this. Lo amaklum. Totally meaningless statements. You can't relinquish your legal rights by simply saying, I am not going to use my legal rights. Okay, now I am. Do me something. So how do you explain the Mishnah? Oh, the Mishnah. Remember that we said before that if you make a kinyan, and remember we had the big machlokas, we ended up asking like a mima, if you make a kinyan, then the kinyan is migufa shel karka. It's not just a kinyan to support your meaningless statement. It's a real kinyan. Okay, so that's what we did over here. Obviously, there was a maisa kinyan, and that was the way that she bowed out. But even a maisa kinyan doesn't matter in this case, because we have another very important consideration, which Gavi's about to write down, and that is the Taina. Nachat ruach asiti lebali. A woman can always claim, just because I signed off on a deal doesn't mean a darn thing. Do you know what kind of pressure I was under? My husband needed money desperately. He had a field that he wanted to sell. The guy said, I'm not buying this field until your wife signs off that she's not going to come after me in the event of a divorce or your death. So my husband's making me hell the whole week. So I decide, you know what? What can you do? I guess I better sign. And then I'll argue down in court. So even though I'd signed, I was forced to sign. That's not something. I mean, anybody would know that. What do you want from my life? After all, there is a Beferish Mishnah in Gittin that says exactly this. Milo Tana, and it says in the Mishnah like this. Somebody buys a field from a guy. And then he goes to the wife and he says, listen, I'm about to put money into this field. I want you to sign on it that you are selling this field too, and you will not come after me for any kind of liens that you have. And if she then signs, it doesn't mean anything. It's bottle. Why is it bottle? Because her kinyan doesn't mean anything. So then how come over here the Mishnah assumes that she can sign off and that she will not go after the buyer? I mean, we've got a Mishnah that says Beferish otherwise. Omer of Zerah, Omer of Chista. Look, there are two different shitas. And it's not a big problem. Look, Kasha, our Mishnah was going on Libra Rebbe Meir. And the Mishnah in Gittin was going on Libra Rebbe Yehuda. We know that there's a machlokus about this particular issue. The Tanya, Katav L'Rishon V'lo Chatmala. Let's say a husband goes ahead, sells a field. He comes to the woman and he says, sign off, honey. And she says, drop dead. So, okay. So the husband goes ahead, meanwhile, and sells another field to another guy. And he comes to the wife and he says, sign off, honey. And she does. Then she cannot collect her ksuva from anybody. So says Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, she can always say, my husband was putting me through hell. What do you have against me? I don't understand. Are you unaware of the facts of life? A woman who signs something does it because she has no choice. So please go away. Okay, so then that's exactly the issue, right? So apparently, there's a machlokas Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda about whether this taina nachas ruach asiti lavali is sufficient to undo the validity of her signature, her kinyan, on exactly this situation. So therefore, Reb Nachman is reading this. Some read it as a statement. So which is the mashmot in Rashi. Rebbe was soysen in ksuvas, like Rebbe Meir, and that she can sign off, and you can't say that. And Rebbe was sosam la'asam over there in Gittin. He went alibi to Rebbe Yehuda. Now many Rishonim learned, what? The Rebbe, sasam la'achak Rebbe Meir, v'sasam la'asam Rebbe Yehuda. What kind of weird answer is that? And then the next thing is a response to that taina. But the idea is basically the same. Omer of Papa, what's the problem? It's very simple. If our Mishnah is talking about a divorcee and the divorcee signed off, well, she certainly can't say she wrote this out after she got a divorce. She's not going to say she did this in order to do nachas ruach to this guy that she wants to shoot. Probably this guy who bought it is her lover, and that's why she signed off. So in that case, we're not going to accept her taina nachas ruach asiti lavali. Ravashi says, I don't even understand what the problem. The problem is ridiculous. Everybody, both Mishnayos are perfectly fine, according to Rabbi Meir. You're right that Rabbi Meir says that we do accept her signing off. But there's two different cases over here. What did Rabbi Meir say? Tell me what the braisa is. She signed off in a case where there were two buyers. The first guy who presented her with a contract, she said to him, drop dead. And the second one she signed off on. So what is she going to say? I always do what my husband wants. Yeah, that's why you told him to drop dead. When you didn't want to do what your husband wants, it was fine for you to say, absolutely not. And now all of a sudden, you're playing the role of the poor, dutiful wife who always does what her husband wants. That's where we say that you cannot claim such a claim. Rabbi Meir didn't say in all circumstances you can't claim that, because it's only over there we've got the two separate properties. And then they could say to her, well, I mean, if you're such a dutiful wife, ni'ita d'nachat ruach abadet, so how come you didn't do that for the first buyer? So in the other case, where we only sold to one, so of course Rabbi Meir agrees, and our Mishnah is talking about that you sold to a guy where before, I mean, what are you saying? The Mishnah should have said that she sold before to a guy. Well, the Mishnah simply says, in the event that she signed off, now you guys decide what the event is, okay? If you work it out that the only way that she could sign off in a binding fashion is if she told another guy to drop dead, so fine, so that's the case. I'm not here to discuss this issue. I'm only here to talk about an uvda. Uvda was, she signed off. You can argue yourselves off in the other room what the case was, all right? So don't ask me a kasha from this Mishnah, and don't present me with cups of coffee when I have Gavi and Akiva to present me with serious stuff. Thank you. All right. So if we're talking about in our Mishnah where there was a different sale, which I don't need to mention, so then she can't say nachas ruach. That's the case, okay? So what's your problem? Now, what's interesting is the klal. Now, this is a klal that we already have written down, assuming that when Gavi's driving, he nonetheless subsequently writes it down. And that is that ein nifraim, since today is basically, remember, is going for the zikrin, the aliyas haneshama, we can really be pretty abusive because he's not going to run away if all of this is aliyas nishmas Yisrael ben Aryeh. So he's taking Barnea's place today. Fine.
It's so, a special day for me too. This is 40 days since Rebbe's psak that I'm a ben Eretz Yisrael. Today is 40 years.
Wow, 40 years.
I have sukkahs.
Excellent. So mazel tov, mazel tov. It's great. Okay, so if that's the case, then we can actually discuss that klal, which we hadn't gotten. Ein nifraim min chasim meshuvatim b'makom sheyesh dechasim b'nei chorin, and Gavi has to add the words afilu hein ziburit. Now that mission is discussing damages. Remember that damages are collected from what? The best of your nechasim, as it says beferish in the pasuk. Meitav. Meitav means idit. You left behind, when you collected or you bought a property, you left behind only ziburit. Can a person who suffered damages, you know, has a claim for damages against this person, say, you've got a crummy piece of property, and that guy, you sold your best property to, and I have a claim against your best property, so I'm going to go take it from him? Or does he have a right to say, I did my due diligence, I'm not mechuyev to leave you the property that you would like. I only need to leave you the ability to collect. The halacha is that we never collect with a lien if we have unencumbered property. And I don't care what the level is. Now, of course, this was not does not necessarily mean that it's irrelevant. Because remember the case where Reuven sold everything to Shimon, and Shimon sold one field to Levi. That over there, the question of whether Reuven's Baal Chov could collect from Levi or Shimon, there it did matter. But that's because that was only a reflected halacha of due diligence, since the real takana was against Reuven's property. There it did make a difference, but it's important to keep that in mind. It doesn't mean that it's never relevant. But normally, if it's against the original debtor and the person that he sold to, makes no difference. There was pre-unencumbered property. I left it behind. I did my share. The Chachamim were metakein. Nobody can come after me because I did whatever I had to do. This is like an amazing nekuda, remember, that the concept of due diligence was built into the idea of Mechiras HaSadeh all the way back at the time of the Mishnah. So the most sophisticated issues are basically all dealt with over here. And surprisingly, we introduce them to you in terms of ksuvas, because it's there that we're doing our due diligence for shaktu. And the word shaktu literally means diligence. There you go. So you want to talk about due diligence, the right place to look is ksuvas. Okay. So now the question is like this. How about if something happened to the free properties? Huh? Maybe there was a hurricane and now the free property is underwater. It is no longer worth very much, and therefore I want to go and collect my debt from someone who had previously bought a property, but he did due diligence. He left behind his beautiful Orlando, Florida property. So what happens now if it's underwater? What's the din? In other words, what is the most important element in this takana? The protection of those who do their due diligence, and that's where it starts? Or is it that we want most to be able to protect liens as long as it's not a standard breakdown in the property insurance? Okay, tashma. Let's look at a bright. Katav l'rishon v'lo chatmalo. We talked about this a minute ago. A husband writes this bill of sale. And the wife says to the guy who wants her to sign off, drop dead. And then the second guy comes along to whom he sells another property. And over there, she does sign it. She cannot collect her ketuvah from anybody. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Now, the question is, why would not this be essentially a case where a person did due diligence and then something happened to the property? In this case, the hurricane was her. That's why they always used to name the hurricane after women, was because of this Mishnah. Then when they forgot where it all comes from, they started giving men's name to hurricanes, just outrageous. But anyway, so she came along now, and she was the hurricane because she promised that she's not going to collect from the very property that I did my due diligence with. I said, I left behind that beautiful property. We'll call it Exhibit B. And then she comes along and says, I sign off from ever attacking Exhibit B. So now I want to go over after Exhibit A. Aha. So if she's the hurricane, if she has a right to now go over after something else, so then that would mean that she didn't lose her ksuva. Since you're telling me that she did lose her ksuva, it must mean that Exhibit A, who did due diligence, is no longer open to attack just because Hurricane Her happened to Exhibit B, right? So there's your answer about Orlando. Aha. Because Isaac, if you're going to tell me that the property underwater allows you to go ahead and attack with your lien from somebody who did leave you a property to collect from because he did do his due diligence, why can't she collect from Exhibit A? She cannot collect from the second one, but she said to the first guy to drop dead. So why can't she come along and collect from him? Because she ruined with her hurricane the other property. Now there's an obvious answer, which I'm sure you're all thinking. And you should just know that, of course, the Gemara will get to that answer. And that is that if you yourself are the hurricane, then you have no one but yourself to blame for the fact that you can't go after the other piece of property. But how does that prove that if there really were a hurricane, that you wouldn't be able to? You can't bring a riot from that. That's the obvious difference. Okay, but before we get to that difference, Reb Nachman says, well, maybe it doesn't mean she loses her right to her ksuva. Maybe it means she loses her right to getting her ksuva from the second property. But maybe she could still collect from Exhibit A, right? Amar Rava, yeah, sure. Okay, stay chuvot b'davar. I've got to, Rava often does this, as you'll recall. There's two reasons why that's ridiculous, okay? First of all, the word ibda means ibda. It doesn't mean partially ibda. If you want to say that she can't collect from number two, then that's what you say. You never say, well, she's lost her ksuva. Why'd she lose her ksuva? What a ridiculous way to say that. So obviously, if you're telling me ibda, it means totally ibda. It's lost. That's what the word lost means. Okay? That's the first point. The ode, but then besides that, we have a braita that shows that that's wrong. The braita says like this. A guy borrows from a certain person, and then he sells his property to two different people. So he's got property, sells first to one, then to another. Now, the person that he borrowed from writes din udvarim ein li'imach to exhibit B, in this case, the second property that he sells. He cannot come and claim from the person who bought the first piece of property, I have a lien against your property. Because that person can always say, hinachti lecha makom ligvote menu. So it says clearly in the Braita that in such a case, if you left a place, due diligence prevents you from going ahead and collecting against an individual who did due diligence. So if that's the case, you see that a woman who gave up on her right to collect her ketuvah cannot go ahead and take it from a guy who had done his due diligence and can say, hinachti lecha makom, to collect. However, don't be stupid, says Rava, and try to prove from here that that means that if it's in a hurricane, that you actually lost it. That's not true. Because obviously, if you are the hurricane, then you cannot go ahead and claim, I'm going to collect against your due diligence because you didn't protect yourself against Hurricane Her. Uh-uh. That's absurd. Hatam Yuda Afsid Nafshe. Listen, you basically destroyed your rights by destroying your ability to collect from the free property. So how can you then go ahead and say, well, you didn't cover it against a hurricane. If you're the hurricane, then don't be a hurricane. So that doesn't prove anything. So, okay, it means that we do not have an answer, right? Because basically all that we've seen is that in the case of this Balchov, or in the case of the woman who was signing off over there, of course they can't go and collect from someone who did due diligence. That's because they were the one who ruined it. But that's not what we were asking. We were asking, what if there was a hurricane? Which is more important? The fact that the person did due diligence or the question of protecting the lien? Ormelei Rav Yehi Amar Lav Rav Ashi. Well, let's note the fact that there is nobody who doesn't know the answer to that question, because there is the standard famous precedent. And every court that is even a little bit competent is well aware of this famous case. Here's the case. A guy went ahead and he borrowed money with a mortgage. Now, remember we had before, Gavi, a mashkanta de sura. A mashkanta de sura is an interesting type of arrangement by which you take a mortgage out on, let's say, a field, and you make a deal. The bank is going to utilize the produce of this field for the next 10 years, let's say, and then using the income from that is going to give you back free and clear. Okay, so if that's the case, it should be fine, except for one little problem. The field, in this case, it was a pardes, so he had a vineyard, and it stopped producing. It was kash, got old, and it no longer produced. So it turned out that they only had 5 years and not 10 years of produce. Therefore, they want the rest of the loan, which is guaranteed by this mortgage. So they go to court. And they go to court, and they ask for a tirfa for the remainder, 50% of the loan that hasn't been paid back because they only got 5 years out of 10. Okay, they get the court to write a tirfa to collect from any buyers. Now, wait a minute. The buyers say, we did due diligence. These guys had a vineyard, and they were actually producing in this vineyard. So we left you property to collect from. Now you're saying, well, a hurricane happened, so now we're coming after you. Apparently, you see that you can actually go back and say, look, I'm very sorry, but the property that you left for me didn't work. And therefore, I want to collect from your property. And apparently, you can. No. This is not precedent for the case we're talking about. Hurricanes are not, or once upon a time, were not foreseeable. Okay. And in this case, everybody knows that you're taking a big risk. When you do a mashkanta de sura and you believe that a field or a pardes is going to continue to produce for 10 years, that's making a lot of assumptions because vines produce for a certain amount of time. You never know when you own a dog how long the dog is going to live, but you're certainly not going to make a mashkanta on a 14-year-old dog. So now if I'm going ahead and I'm making a mashkanta on a bunch of grapevines, then you know perfectly well that I may come after you after 5 years, 6 years, because nobody can guarantee that these are going to continue to produce. So it's very normal for vines to just dry out at one point and they stop producing. You did not do due diligence. You should have thought to yourself, can I really rely on the fact that these people who made that big loan are going to be able to get it all paid back from this vineyard? No. So you were pretty stupid. And therefore, you took a risk and you lost. All right. So then that means what we've been able to prove is that due diligence has to be real due diligence. It has to take also into consideration foreseeable changes. We've also proved that if you are the very source of the problem, so you are the hurricane, then obviously you cannot fight against the other person's due diligence. That's unfair. But we still don't know what if it were not foreseeable and you are not the source. What do we do then? So the question stands, the hurricane, is that considered to be enough of a basis for me to go after a guy who thinks that he properly protected himself, allows me to collect from him, and leaves him to try to collect his property insurance? What's the din? Says the Gemara, the din is that, in fact, ishtaduf b'nei chori torfa mimishabde. If something happened to the unencumbered property, you can go after a property that had been sold that you had a prior lien to. There's your answer. The three cases, we now know what the din is. Now, getting into the Mishnah's idea, the more sophisticated idea of what do we do when we have a vicious cycle in which we can keep going around forever and we want to know how the court's going to deal with that. So here's a case which seems to be similar to the case in the Mishnah. So Amar Abaye, a guy says to a woman who is a Pnuya, we're going to see she was not married, I want to give you this gift of my property, but after you die, this gift is meant to go to so-and-so, my friend. Now, that gives us, by the way, a terminology. We call the person who is meant to get it at the end after her death, Mr. or Mrs. Acharayich. Okay, that's the way we'll refer to them. So the guy who comes after, the girl who comes after you. Now, she then goes ahead and gets married. Now, a husband is considered to be a buyer. And therefore, since she sold it, so to speak, by getting married, how is he a buyer? Because of Takanat Usha. Remember, the Takanat Usha was that if a woman sells her Nichsei Maluk, in this case, she has this property as a Nichsei Maluk. So the halakha was that even if she sells it, if she dies, the husband goes and takes it. So that means that a husband is always considered to be the lokeach rishon. The moment that she dies, he's considered to have bought the property before this other person that she sold it to. That's the takana susha that we read before. Since the husband is considered to be the lokeach, there is no acharayach. Why? Because when he stipulated, when he gave her the gift, anything that's left, nothing was left. She sold it. And since she sold it, there's nothing to give to poor Mr. or Mrs. Acharayach. in this case, because it was sold out from under him. Now, let me just make it clear that this is going according to one Tana, namely Reb Shimon ben Gamliel. Take a look at this bright. In the event that somebody gives a gift and says, I'm giving my property to you, but after your death, it goes to Mr. Acharecha. So then, if the first guy goes ahead and sells it, Rebbe says, what do you mean? He had no right to sell it. The person gave it with the understanding that he can only use it. And all he was given was the right to the payroll, because it was a stipulation that after the original recipient dies, it goes to someone else. Which means, look, I'm not really giving you this property. I'm giving you the right to use this property. But once you die and the right expires with you, the actual body of the property goes to someone else. So Rebbe's interpretation of Acharayich is that the rights to this property are the rights to Kinyan Peirot and not to Kinyan Aguf. Actually, the understanding of the Machlokas Rebbe and Reb Shimon Gamliel is itself from Machlokas, but we're taking the simple approach to understanding that Machlokas. So this is what Rebbe said over there, and that's how we're understanding it. Okay, now, in the event that this happens, Reb Shimon Gamliel says, no, actually, you were given the rights to the body of the property. If you sold the property, then there is no property. So in the event that the original recipient dies and he had already sold the property, poor Acharayich is up the creek without a paddle and was cheated out of this potential gift. So if you hold like Reb Shimon ben Gamliel, then you pass him like Abaye. Abaye said, well, the husband is a buyer. And she went ahead and she got married. So then she sold it. So now Miss Acharayich is up the creek. But Abaye couldn't have said that. Well, Abaye was the one who said, when the Mishnah talks about the horrible people in the world that are called Mivalei Olam, people that end up destroying the world. There's a whole list of people like that. Religious people, people who are Rasha Orom, and so on. So the Gemara gives examples. What do we mean by religious people? Well, they make themselves look very holy by being ascetics, so on. The case of what is a Rosh Aram, which is another one, really a very clever evil person. What is that? Ezel Rosh Aram. That's somebody who goes to a person who got a gift of this sort, who was told after your death, the gift goes to Acharech, or Acharecha, right? And he says to him, you know what? If you die, nothing's going to be left. I don't understand. You actually want to give all of this money to Acharech to go buy first-class plane tickets? Ridiculous. Go sell it now. Get what you can out of the property and live it up and go to Las Vegas. So if you give that etzah to someone, you are a real bum. Because the person who gave that gift obviously intended it to go to Acharayim. Now, how could Abaye issue a psak that is basically telling people, by the way, you could always do that. Abaye says, only evildoers do that kind of etzah. So doesn't make sense for Abaye to have made a psak like Reb Shimon ben Gamliel and make it public. Well, what do you mean make it public? Abaye never said that she should get married, Tina say. She went ahead and got married, okay? I mean, that happens all the time. People get married. I mean, so what is she supposed to do? Never get married? So Abaye was just saying, if the fact that she went ahead and get married, so then the husband is going to end up being the owner of this property. And in effect, it was sold because of Takanas Usha. That's all that he's saying. I mean, so what are you saying? So she should never get married. I mean, that's not the point. So the eights, I'm not going to be eights to do something to mess someone up. Now, another thing that Abaye said goes like this. Furthermore, Abaye said, along the lines that we're talking about, that this sounds awfully like our vicious cycle. He says to someone, and he says to a woman, now, Lemaisa, in the end, we're going to figure out that this woman was already married. Not like the case we had before where she wasn't married at the time. So she was already married. He gives her the property and he says, I'm giving you this property. And after your death, it goes to Mr. So-and-so. She goes ahead and she sells the property and then she dies. Now, the moment that she dies, we recognize the husband as being the first buyer because of Takana Susha. Since he was the first buyer, the earlier buyer, so he can take it away based on Takana Susha. He can take it away from anybody who bought it. Now, the moment that he takes it away from anyone who bought it, Mr. Acharayich can come along and take it away from the husband. Now, later on, we're going to explain that the reason that Mr. Acharayich could take it away from the husband is because if somebody made this tonight, I'm giving you this property, and after your death, it goes to Mr. Acharayich, then what he is doing is essentially saying, I am giving you this property on condition that your husband, to whom you are currently married, does not have any rights to it. Now, if you do that, remember, you can even give money to an eved who doesn't have rights to property. You can certainly give money to a woman and say, this gift is yours on condition that your husband doesn't get his filthy paws on this money. So then, by definition, it's hers, because the moment he tries to take it, it wasn't hers in the first place. So then it is hers. So then he has no right to take it, which is itself an expression of exactly this type of vicious cycle. And therefore, it works to prevent the husband from touching that money. Since we're going to see that we're talking about she's already married when he said that, the moment that he utilizes his rights to the earlier buyer because of Takanas Usha, Mr. Acharayich can come along and take it away from him because he says, well, excuse me, it's meant to come to me because your wife died and it was given to her on condition that it goes to me and not to you. So if you're going to take it, I'm going to take it from you. But then the buyer who had been sold by her, he could come and take it from Mr. Acharayich because he says, well, if a buyer holds like Reb Shimon Ben Gamliel, he says that that was a kosher mechira, because since Acharayich means in the event that anything is left after you die, well, she sold it. So nothing was left after she died, right? So she sold it to him. So he comes and he says, excuse me, I bought this before she died, and you, therefore, are Mr. Theoretical Acharayich. But remember that you're up the creek without a paddle, because you're only theoretical. And then we leave it all in the hands of the buyer at this point. Now, wait a minute over here. How come the husband can't come back and say, what do you mean? You can't leave it in the hands of the buyer. I'm the first buyer. That was Takanas Usha. So then the husband should get it, and then we should go round and round the mulberry bush again, which of course should mean that the psak is that the Besdin should sit back and say, listen, we don't have time to play this frivolous nonsense. You guys make a deal between yourselves and come present it to the court, and then the court will enforce it. Same thing like our Mishnah, right? So ask the Gemara, why is it different than our Mishnah? This seems to be exactly the same situation. Maishnami hod, it's not. In the Mishnah, it says, round and round the mulberry bush, v'chozrot chalila, achi yasu pshara b'nehem. And as Tosafos explained, it means that virtually they'll go round and round the mulberry bush, and it will stop when they make a pshara. But here, Abai is saying, nope, it stops in the hands of the lokeach. Why do we look at it that way? We have a lokeach rishon. It should keep going, says the Gemara, because at the point that it lands up in the hands of the buyer, we're not going to give it to the lokeach rishon because he can't really enforce it since it's going to be taken from him. But why? Why arbitrarily stop there? Because it's not arbitrarily. That's the point. In this case, note, when you're talking about the Mishnah, everybody is involved with their property. The women are involved. They're owed a ksuva. That's real money. And the buyer is involved, or a lender is involved, because it was real money. Everybody's got real money. And since everybody's got real money, they have to come to an arrangement. But in this case, there's only one person who actually is going to lose money. There's only one person who put money out in this, and that is the buyer and nobody else. In the Mishnah, they're owned obviously they're owed the ksuva. So in this case, the only one who actually spent money, everybody else is a gift recipient, right? So you're saying, I want my gift. No, you want your gift. And this guy spent $1 million thinking that he had a right to buy this gift. So therefore, the one who stands to suffer whatever loss of money is only the lokeach. So the lokeach who de eat leip seda, and therefore we will stop at that point in the mulberry bush. Now Raphran went ahead and said this over to Ravashi, and he said, well, how is that possible that Abaya said this? Didn't Abaya say right before that? Now, we know the answer to this because we know the case that Abaya originally said it to was before she get the gift before she was married. Then she went ahead and married. And that Alibet of Shimon ben Gamliel was a kosher sale. Mashenkin, in this case, we're talking about where he gave the gift to a woman who was married and therefore was the equivalent of making it tonight that the husband will never get this property. So, but we knew that because we peeked ahead. But now Rav Ashi is presented with the problem of how did Abaya ever say such a thing? Because Amar Abaya, but just a minute ago, we had the case where if a guy says to a woman, I'm giving you my property, and after your death, the property goes to Miss Acharaya, that if she goes ahead and gets married, so then the Baal is considered to be the first buyer. And because of that, the poor Miss Acharaya doesn't get a darn thing. Because it was sold, according to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, it was sold before it ever happened that Acharayach would come because she hadn't died before selling it. Now, how come all of a sudden he says that Acharayach can take it from the husband? Amale said, Rav Ashi, it's a different case. The first case, as we explained, was talking about when the gift was made before she got married. So then when she goes and gets married, it's the equivalent of selling it to the Baal, even though that sale goes into effect at her death. He's a lokeach rishon. But over here, he said this to her while she already was married. So basically, what is he saying? He knows that she's married, and he's giving her a property with a stipulation that after you die, this goes to Acharayach. So what does that mean? What's he saying? What do you think he's saying? Michael Amarla, he's saying that if you die, then this goes only to Acharayach and not to your husband. So as if you made it tonight, that the husband never gets his paws into this. Fine. Now everything makes sense. When we go around the mulberry bush makes sense. When we don't make sense, but what still doesn't make complete sense is the closing words of the Mishnah. You said it's the same thing with a Baal Chov, and it's the same thing with a woman who is collecting her ksuva, which means what? So the Brisa says, what we're talking about over here is in the event that you have a Baal Chov who also is presented with two buyers, like the case that we talked about before, right? So let's say Shimon owes 100 zuz to Reuven. Shimon goes ahead, sells two different pieces of property. This was a case we talked about earlier. He sells it to two different people in this case, and he sells each one for half, meaning for 50. Okay, now Reuven goes ahead and he agrees not to take away the field from, but only not to pursue his rights. He didn't give up on the loan. So he agreed not to pursue his rights from the guy who bought second. Okay, so now he still has his she'ibud. He can collect from the first lokeach because he didn't sign off on that. So now he still gets 50 more zuz. So now the first lokeach is going to go and take away the field from the second lokeach. because he has Achrayas Nechasim. So he can collect. Once he collects, then Reuven is going to go and say, well, I never gave up on my she'ibud, so I have a she'ibud that allows me to collect. But then the second lokeach, he takes it back, because after all, Reuven says he's never going to pursue anything against Shimon, and so here too, it's round and round the mulberry bush, and they have to come and present the court with an agreement, which then the court will enforce. The same thing would be true about an isha ba'alat chov. That's the same case, except over here, take out the suit for a loan and insert instead a wife who's looking for a ksuva. And here the husband sold two fields, which if you put them together, they add up to the value of her ksuva. She then gives away her right to pursue against the lokeach of the second lokeach, and then she collects from the first lokeach, who then goes back and collects from the second lokeach, and round around the mulberry bush. And that's the case that the Mishnah was referring to when it said you could substitute any two creditors or a woman for a ksuva. It's very simple. And this brings us to a very important moment in our relationship with the famous Capitan. And we do have precedent for this case that every Bezdin is aware of. Hadran alach mishayana sui.
Bli neder.
Excellent.
Shall we funk in the Helik of Perek now or wait?
No, I think we can do that tomorrow. You know, I walked out of my house on my way to davening yesterday, and I bump into this guy that I know for like over 60 years. Been following him. We're a little bit like related through marriage. And this is a guy who's been married three times. I say to him, now look, obviously he's a psychologist, you know, so of course he's married three times. I said to him, but the Daf Yomi is Mishayana Sur Shalosh Nashim Vameit. So what the heck is going on? This guy's 80 years old. He's very young. So he says, well, I kept the last two marriages very short, but if you got any suggestions, I'm ready. The next mission is four wives. My parting words were, some people never learn. Anyway, have a wonderful, wonderful day. And we look forward to the Aliyas Neshama of Gavi's grandfather, Bezrat Hashem, who I'm sure definitely had a lot of fun with this stuff, had a lot of fun watching his grandson learn it. And so, Bezras Hashem, what greater hana'ah can one give to those who were and are still part of the flow of life?